This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking about climate change, but our focus is not on government policy, nor the politics of climate change, or even the science. Instead, we're exploring how our brains process the information we receive about the way our planet is changing, and how that affects how we respond to it. We're talking about the psychology of climate change. Renee Lertzman is here with me today. She's a psychologist and a pioneer at the intersection of climate change and psychology. Renee, welcome.
Hi, Kim. Happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Renee, listen with me to a sampling of what we're hearing day in and day out.
The future looks bleak. Warming in the last century has been faster than at any time in the past several million years.
Records are shattering by the month, and temperatures within the Arctic Circle hit an astonishing 86 degrees Fahrenheit this week.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
Droughts crippling Cape Town, South Africa, and heat waves turning Europe brown.
We are on the verge of the abyss.
Renee, this sounds so dire. How do we take in news like this?
Right. Well, chances are right now, everyone who's listening is a little bit disassociated. Mm-hmm. You know, this is incredibly complicated and emotionally charged content. And when we're confronted with this, it's very normal and natural to have a lot of very complicated responses and feelings. Chances are, I don't know about you, but I feel anxious. I feel worried and distressed. Part of me wants to not even be having this conversation. So mm-hmm. Some folks might right now be actually feeling like, I don't know if I can listen to this show. I think I might need to change the channel or tune out some ambivalence. And chances are that a lot of people are also feeling a desire to want to be engaged and an aspiration to stay connected with what's happening. And all of those things come together often in a matter of seconds, which can lead to a sort of a partial or full tuning out or an emotional hijack.
So I want to step back a little bit because you've been looking at climate change from a psychological perspective for a long time. Can you tell us how you came to this?
Sure. So for me, it really started when I was a student in college. During my first year, I was a psychology major, and I was, quite clear I was going to become a psychologist. And at the time, I thought I was going to go into a private practice. And I happened to take an environmental studies, sort of one of these introductory courses. And that's when I was catapulted into a very unexpected emotional journey where I didn't really understand how it was that we were talking about climate change and environmental issues and crises, whether policy, science, you name it, without recognizing one, to me, it was an obvious psychological challenge, a psychological phenomenon that is so distressing and overwhelming and just brings a whole variety of complex issues to contend with. I didn't understand on the side of those working on environment and climate change why we weren't talking about that. And then on the other hand, I was going to my psychology classes and there was no mention of any of this. And I found that very strange. So I was sort of, catapulted into this world where I felt very alone. I felt overwhelmed. And I decided then and there to really understand as deeply as I could, what is the psychology of climate change and environmental issues? What happens when we become aware? And why is it that so many people, why is it that humans have this ability to actually, as you said in the opening, turn a blind eye to issues that are so fundamental to our existence and life on the planet, and even threatening what we all love and care about. What's going on there? So I really wanted to understand that.
So help us get started to understand that. Is it a factor that we get so much information and frankly, so much bad news about it, that it actually makes it harder to act, that it causes us to tune out?
Right. Well, so I think it's actually a bit more complicated than that. We tend to think of this in terms of, you know, good news and bad news, and that we ricochet between, well, it's all very dire and it's the bad news and the doom and gloom, and we need to focus, you know, that's bringing us down. And then, and that what that suggests is we should only focus on solutions and more positive, hopeful stories. And it's actually so much more complicated than that. You know, first of all, we should just recognize that climate change is really a symptom of a systemic problem or series of problems, right? Like climate change itself is not the problem. It's a symptom of underlying systemic issues that have to do with how humans have been living on the planet. And what that means is that when we hear about the news, the bad news, the dire warnings, what it suggests is that something fundamentally is wrong, you know, with how we've been living and our way of life. But then because of the scale, we're talking about such a huge scale and scope, it isn't necessarily clear, okay, what do I do and how do I engage with this? And that can send a lot of people into a bit of a, what I would call a short circuit, sort of a, it's sort of like we get emotionally engaged, like this is distressing. It's upsetting. I don't know what I can possibly do. And then we check out. Like a lot of people just kind of tune out, check out, numb out, or become really despairing or really angry. But there's a kind of a quick loop that can happen because of the scale and the scope and the implications of the issues. And then add to that the emotional content, which is, you know, it's very rare that we talk openly about how upsetting this is. And from a psychological perspective, it's very healthy and it's essential if we want to be able to move through something and move through into more, you know, proactive, constructive change. We need to be able to talk about also, well, this is actually upsetting. This is overwhelming. This is making me feel, you know, X, Y, and Z. And when we're not doing that, we're sort of not fully able to, I think, get ourselves around, our minds around this. So there's a whole variety of things going on here that make it very hard to break the cycle of the tendency to just want to check out and just want to tune it out.
And I just want to say, we'll talk a little bit about denial, which is something different, climate denial, which is something different a little bit later. But I want to drill in on this idea that it seems like it's so much, it's overwhelming to think about where you even start. How is climate different than other crises that we've seen people mobilize and react to, such as the Black Lives Matter movement or, you know, some folks at least really pushing and during the pandemic to make sure that people were safe and that they had their vaccines. That those are also really big problems that people can't solve individually, but we've seen more galvanizing and quick movement. Why doesn't that same thing happen with climate?
I think that it's a combination of really really complicated factors that we need to recognize. It's sort of a confluence of, you know, psychologically complicated dimensions here. So one is that, as I mentioned, climate change is a system of systemic issues, right, that have to do with how humans live on the planet. So from a psychological perspective, we are a part of it. Not all of us are equally part of it, right? I don't want to suggest that. But as human beings, we are part of the issue. So there's a complicity. And because there's a complicity, there is there's a sort of cognitive dissonance that can come up for us as we confront the issue, which is I'm part of the problem. I don't want to be part of the problem, but I'm not sure how to not be part of the problem. And so mm-hmm. that's one piece right there, which makes it hard to, for a lot of people, I think, to engage in the way that you've just described. Mm-hmm. So there's that. There's also the systemic, you know, what has been called a wicked problem, right? Which is a whole level of complexity that there's no single actor, right? There's no single, mm-hmm. Our brains are really so honed to focus on problem and solution. And in this case, it just doesn't quite work that way, right? And so, you know, we were trying to hone in on, okay, how do I direct my energy and attention? But it's so systemic and the mm-hmm. scale, right? Both time and space is quite vast. So that's part of the issue. So there's the complicity that we're part of it, which can bring up cognitive dissonance, can bring up guilt and shame and all kinds of stuff. There's the scale and systemic aspect of it, which can make it hard to know how to kind of emotionally regulate to stay engaged and feel like it matters, to feel like one's actions and one's energy is actually making any kind of a difference. And then that's the third part, which is that, again, we're wired to invest our energy, our precious energy, in the direction of actions that we have a pretty good sense will actually pay off.
So, Renee, I'm going to pause you right there. Stay with me. We're discussing climate change in our human psychology. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about climate change and how our feelings can affect our ability to act. With me today is Renee Lertzman. She's a psychologist, consultant, and founder of Project Inside Out, where she works to provide resources for people and communities so they can address climate change and sustainability issues. So, Renee, I just want to play a couple of things we heard from our listeners on this topic. Glenn from Maynard, Massachusetts, it's called and left us this message.
The huge numbers of us make it incredibly hard to change things rapidly, yet that is what we're attempting to do. This is unquestionably difficult and confusing. What do we do first? How do we prioritize? How do we come to agreement on these things among literally millions and millions of people worldwide? That's the core of the problem.
And Daniel called in to say we can't place the burden of change solely on individuals.
Because of the way our infrastructure is built, our power is generated, the way our products are transported, all of these things mean that just being alive in a modern society saddles you with an enormous pollution footprint, even if you make every personal choice you can to minimize your impact. The problem is we keep emphasizing individual responses to what are society-level problems. We need policy, regulation, and modern infrastructure improvements that reduce the default level of pollution that everyone is responsible for.
So, Renee, these comments seem to be getting exactly to what you were talking about, the magnitude of the problem, how small individual contributions work. Daniel, the last caller was essentially saying, look, we need bigger systems to work first for individuals to respond. Talk about the psychology behind that idea that, you know, we are all, each of us is just one person.
Right, exactly. So we're wired, again, this is cultural and social conditioning to default to the individual, particularly in the Western cultures, right, that we go there. But to the point of the caller, we're also, there's a tendency to shift the focus and the burden on the individual that we've seen playing out over a number of decades, which is what I would call work avoidance. It's avoiding the work, the real work of addressing system change. But, you know, the way I would reframe this is that we need to get away from a binary of individual versus system. I think that gets us into kind of a dead end, and it wastes a lot of energy and time. Because if you really look at what is policy, what is infrastructural change, what is social movement change, it's comprised of individuals who come together and activate and make all kinds of things happen. We cannot think really in terms of only individual versus system, but I think our brains tend to do that to manage the overwhelm, to manage the complexity. It's just what we do. We kind of go towards a bit of a reductive, and I'm not saying the caller was being reductive at all.
Sure.
Right. But that we tend to do that. And I think we have an opportunity right now to reframe this and to say, yes, it can't just, it's not on any one individual, and it's absolutely not an individual lifestyle issue at all, but it's a yes. And it's a, how do we join up the dots? And I actually think that if we bring that kind of attention, that emotional intelligence into how we approach policy and how we approach infrastructural change and innovation and all of that, we would find that these distinctions become less less clear, and that, you know, it's fundamentally about how do we as humans engage, right? This is humans are what are going to get us out of this. Yeah, but those were really very insightful comments.
So let me bring another voice into our conversation. Rosimar Rios Berrios is an atmospheric scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. She studies hurricanes and heavy precipitation events. And she's also a member of Science Moms, a group of climate scientists and mothers who are working to spur others into action. Rosie, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, tell us how you got involved with studying atmospheric science and climate change.
Sure. So I grew up in Puerto Rico, and as many of our listeners know, Puerto Rico is right on the path of hurricanes every summer. So growing up, hurricanes were very familiar to me, and I went through some of them, some pretty bad that left us without power or water for several months. But something that always intrigued me was that whenever there was a hurricane or a tropical storm nearby, we didn't know for sure if it was going to impact us. And that was what inspired me to go into science, to try to find ways to improve our understanding and prediction about hurricanes. So for the past decade or so, I've been doing research about hurricanes, but a year ago, I became a mom. And as I became a mom during a very particular year, there were record-breaking hurricanes happening in the Atlantic Ocean. There were wildfires here in Colorado, where I live now. And I was very, very concerned about my baby. And so that changed my whole career into not just doing the science to improve prediction of hurricanes, but also looking for ways to communicate my science to the public to inspire change, especially with respect to climate change.
And so you join the group Science Moms, and it seeks to increase that not just the messaging, but action. Who is your target? Who is your audience? Are you trying to get other moms to respond just as you did after you had your baby? Are you looking to message to a larger audience? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. We listened to Renee earlier saying how this is a societal problem, right? Climate change is happening. It is affecting us all. So this is a problem that affects everybody. But moms in particular are concerned about climate change and how it affects our children. There are studies that have shown that about 80% of moms are concerned about climate change versus about 60% of the public. So our target audience is moms for that reason, but also because moms just have this unique ability of getting things done. And so we're targeting moms. We are also moms at Science Moms. We're climate scientists and moms. And we know that moms trust other moms. Just last weekend, I was asking a mom friend, what kind of shoes should I use for my baby that is just beginning to walk? So we hope that by breaking down the message into simple ways and coming from moms to other moms, we can inspire the moms group to take action.
So some of our listeners may have seen one of the very creative outreach videos that Science Moms has produced online. Here is one of them.
Jaden, get that out of your mouth!
Put your pants back on!
Where are your shoes?
We need the outside.
I don't know what I'd do without this park.
So when I hear climate experts like the Science Moms say that the outside will be vastly different in much worse ways for my children...
Well, I don't like that!
That's when I start using my outside voice, even if I'm inside.
So use your outside voice to tell Congress why you're worried about climate change.
Let's protect our kids' future. Later's too late.
So, Renee, I want to come back to you for a moment. And, you know, you heard Rosie talking about how they're reaching out to other moms because moms listen to other moms. They turn to other moms. And clearly this ad is aimed to capitalize in a humorous way on that. But talk about the psychology of that. Is that one way to sort of break through this feeling of being overwhelmed?
Oh, absolutely. I love that. So first off, humor and wit is really powerful and really disarming in this work. So I think we should be doing much more of that because it helps us actually cope and manage with distressing issues in a safer way. So there's that. And then there's, you know, one of the things that I advise when we talk about how do we navigate these emotionally complicated issues is by joining up with others. So this can't really be underestimated enough is that we need to find our people. You know, we need to find all of this really needs to happen in relationship, right? And so finding those communities, the groups, the networks, that we can just totally be ourselves and show up our, you know, full kind of however we are relating with the issues is totally vital. So I love what Science Moms is doing here in that they're joining these worlds up. And it's really awesome.
And Rosie, I want to get back to you. I mean, we're talking about how it has been difficult for most people to really engage for all the reasons that Renee is walking us through. What was it for you? I mean, you talked about having your baby, but how do you stay encouraged? How do you keep that level of engagement on this issue?
Right. So it can be very difficult to find what kind of actions we can take that will make a difference. And so keeping engaged is a very particular problem because it's not until it hits us close that we realize this problem is affecting me, right? If we're thinking in terms of the individualistic level. But if we take the moment, for example, at sciencemoms.com, we have a very simple template to send a letter to our congresspeople. And if we take just that quick 5 minutes to go there and send that letter, and then if we can see that that letter actually makes a change, that if we start seeing change coming up from our state, local, even federal leaders, that's one way in which we can stay engaged. We can see the difference that we're making through our actions.
And Renee, that's a good example, something concrete that people can do. Is that the way that people mm-hmm. can really start to overcome the urge to look away or sort of stay stagnant?
Yes. Yes, I would say yes and. So okay. A lot of research supports the fact that we do need to be active. We do need to be engaged. We need to be able to take our responses and feelings and channel that into some sort of activity that actually reduces our anxiety and regulates our nervous system. So without question, but I would actually, I'm not in 100% agreement with the premise that we all need, that this is applies to everyone, and that we will not act unless, you know, it hits close to home, i.e. having a child. You know, for a lot of people, it does, that is the turning point. You know, I know a ton of people who, once they have a child, it's like, you know, the light goes on. So that's a real thing. But I think it's important to recognize there are millions of people around the planet who are feeling equally engaged and passionate, who are not necessarily directly impacted by climate in a variety of ways. And that's where we, you know, where it's about our imagination and our cognitive ability to put ourselves into the shoes and times and places of others. And that's a real thing too, or we wouldn't have so many people working on climate change. So it's a both and I just want to caution that it's like, there's no one, we want to have a prescription. I'm asked every day, you know, what do you prescribe? You know, what should we do? Should we all do this? Should we all do that? And I'm always, you know, kind of deflecting that a little bit to say, you know what, we have to find out what works and makes sense for each of us. For me, writing a letter is not how I channel my energy. Right. But for me, right, convening a conversation, a group circle, let's say, in my neighborhood, where we come together and we talk openly, that I can channel my energy in that way. And that's also very powerful. Others might volunteer at a farmer's market. So I think we want to just be very spacious about what does action mean for you, where you are in the world, what your proclivities are, what your talents are, what your energy level is, what your circumstances are, and go from there and create a really wide net for that.
And Rosie, I want to come back to you on that issue. I mean, I know that, you know, letter writing is not the only thing that Science Moms are pushing. What sort of other actions are you encouraging individuals to do, local leaders, national leaders?
Yes. Yeah, so something that Renee brought up is that we need to be talking about it. And so one of the main goals that we have at Science Moms is breaking down climate change into very simple ways that can be understood by everyone, not just moms, right? We're targeting mom, but it can be understood by everyone. So we have a number of content already in the website and a lot more coming, and in our social media channels, where we have simple videos just breaking down what climate change is, what's happening, why is it happening, what can we do about it. And that's one of the ways that we're hoping to enact change, by educating people, by inspiring people to know what is climate change, why is it affecting everyone, and talking about it to their children, if it's the moms that are taking this content in, but also talking to friends, to local leaders about it, keeping the conversation going. That's one of the big things that we're doing at Science Moms. And another thing that we're doing is to try to show our own stories, to show that climate change affects us all in different ways, but it is definitely affecting us all.
Yeah, and to that last point, Rosie, in the minute or so we have left, talk a little bit about conversations that you've had. Have you found, I mean, just talking to you now makes me want to learn more about it. Have you found that it's that connection that individuals make with each other that makes a big difference?
Yes, definitely. So a lot of the times when I say I'm a meteorologist to my friends and other relatives, they always want to hear about, like, what's the latest, and well is this hurricane season going to be very active? Are there hurricanes, like, are there going to be, like, a lot more hurricanes in the future? And just, like, breaking down that information, talking to friends and explaining it to them, it makes them, like, have that aha moment, like, oh, that's what it is. And that's probably one of the challenges that we're facing with climate change, that there is a lot of information out there. And it, really it can is. Be very difficult to take it all
Rosie,
in.
I really appreciate you joining us to help share that information. Rosamar Rios-Berrio studies hurricanes and climate change and is a member of Science Moms. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Renee Lertzman is going to stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point. On Monday, we're kicking off our series on Amazon. We'll be talking about the Prime effect, the ways Amazon is part of pretty much all of our lives, and what that means. We're starting with a basic but complex question. What is Amazon? We want to hear from you. Call and leave us a voicemail finishing this sentence. Amazon is at 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking this hour about climate change and our feelings about and how our feelings might get in the way of taking action. One group of people leading the charge recently and really making their voices heard are young people like this teenage activist in Georgia.
My name is Nicholas Kane Jr. I'm 18 years old. I'm from Clarksdale, Mississippi, but I currently live in Georgia. I have been doing this since I was 15. Growing up in Mississippi, my family is Native. I come from a Native background. So growing up in Mississippi, it was, especially in Mississippi, because it's animals and nature. You know, that's mostly what you see. So that, like, became the second nature to me, honestly. Like, that's what I grew up around. So I always had an intriguement with it. And I was like, I always want to do something with this. But I never knew exactly what it was until that moment. And I woke up one day and there was a story about a wildfire burning a few deers and it was destroying their home. And it just hit me and I was like, I should be, you know, doing something with this because this is what I want to do in the future. And then I started NACAO, the North American Climate Activist Organization. And it wasn't more so of a group, it was a big hub where people who didn't know where to get their foot in the ground could come and meet and talk to other activists and just, you know, find a place to start so they can branch off and do something great. So doing stuff like this over the time and getting denied and made fun of and threats and getting stuff done as fast as you wish and still seeing the decline in the climate change ecosystem and everything, it takes a toll. And it's like, you know, you start off with this glimmer of hope. And as you keep going down, it gets worse. But as I meet new people who are just getting into activism and they have that same optimism, I do, it brings me right back up. You know, that's why they say every little victory counts, because the big victories in this area are very rare. You know, it's rare you're going to see a president or someone come out and completely say, we're going to stop these people from hunting in this area so animals can live, or we're going to stop cars from driving in this area so emissions can go down. Those are very rare. You get the little victories like recycling or pollution awareness, stuff like that. That's what you celebrate. it's a very different scene than what it was a couple of years ago. I can say that because you have people like Alexandria and Greta, and, you know, like people, they'll say, oh, I started young. But I love when they start younger, because that just goes to show how much we really care about this. And it's starting to make a little crack into the corporate side of where they're actually trying to listen to us. Now, will it change immediately? No. Will it change fast? No. But I do see a big turn in that area coming, but it's only a matter of time.
That was 18-year-old Nicholas Kane Jr. He's a youth climate activist in Georgia. Renee Lerthman is still with me. She's a psychologist and a consultant, and she's been working at the intersection of psychology and climate change for decades. So, Renee, listening to Nicholas just now and just, you know, the fire that he has in his belly, I'm reminded of a lot of people I know who have teenagers who often get very energized about certain movements, including climate. And sometimes it can motivate the adults in their lives, and sometimes it makes the adults say, oh, my goodness, I'm so tired of, you know, this child talking about climate change. So talk a little bit about the psychology behind that. Can young people help spur others, sort of make that breakthrough, or does that also put up the same kind of wall that we've been talking about?
Yeah, excellent question. Well, first off, that was incredibly powerful and moving. And I love what he said about it's a big hug. That really goes to the heart of what it is I think we're talking about here, which is really recognizing that this work is hard and it's emotionally charged and takes its toll. And the most powerful thing we can do is to really lean into the emotional support that comes with working and connecting with others. So that was really, really key, really powerful. So when it comes to young people becoming activated, this is something I've spent quite a bit of time looking at. I actually did a project with the Alliance for Climate Education a number of years ago. They had a project called How to Talk About Climate. It was basically for young people, how to support young people in having constructive, productive conversations with their parents and adults in their lives, with the recognition that it's a minefield. And when young people become, the eyes are open, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of righteousness, there's a lot of like, we've got to do this now. There's all of that, you know, adults have failed us, like, what the heck, you know, we've got to get on board. That energy, that orientation can inspire and motivate and mobilize, and it can really trigger and turn the adults in our lives off. So where I'm coming from, and this is sort of the subtext of a lot of what I'm talking about here, is how do we recognize and put at the center of our minds that this is emotionally complicated and charged content, period. And what does that mean? It means we need to really try to be more emotionally intelligent in the way that we navigate and approach these issues. And by emotional intelligence, you know, I don't mean we need to not bring our fire and bring the anger and bring the all of that that we're needing right now. But if we want to be truly effective, you know, the most powerful thing we can do is to temper that with empathy and to temper that with really finding somewhere in ourselves an ability to be curious about the experience of others and to be able to say, hey, you know, I'm feeling, you know, Rosie spoke to this. I'm going through this. I'm feeling like I need to do something. I am feeling frustrated that our family, I'm putting myself in the mind of a teenager in a family system. I'm feeling like we're not doing enough. What's wrong with you? Hey, mom, like, don't you care? You clearly don't care, you know? And that doesn't really lead to a very positive outcome. You know, what we want to see is, this is how I'm feeling, right? And I'm angry. What about you? You know, and how can we have a conversation about this? And, you know, how do we bring in a recognition that, you know, this is maybe brings up a lot of uncomfortable feelings, which include the fact that one of your callers a few minutes ago, when he was saying you can't be alive on the planet without being complicit and contributing to the, you know, the, because we're in a system. I think we need to talk about that very openly and say, you know what, like we've got an SUV, like, okay, what are we going to do about that? You know, a lot of parents feel really torn between, I want to be a good parent. And for me to be a good parent and caregiver, I need to have a safe car. I need to get my kids around. And at the same time, I'm part of the problem because I'm driving this big SUV and it makes me feel like a terrible person. And that actually, I have to tell you, that's where I think we stall out and people get mired in the double bind, where it's like damned if I do and damned if I don't. And the only way through that double bind is by talking about it and by taking as much judgment as we can out of the picture and to say, okay, how do we solve this and navigate this together in a way that really makes sense?
So I mentioned a little earlier that we would get to the issue of denial, which is a little different than what we've been talking about, the mental block in a way that the bigness of the problem and the complexity creates. But talk a little bit about denial. I know folks, I will include myself in this, in the media, tend to talk about this in binary terms. You either believe in science or you don't. But you say that that's not the way it works. Talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think it's important to situate denial in a spectrum. There's soft denial, there's hard denial, there's all kinds of denial. In fact, I would argue that each one of us right now are in some form of denial or we wouldn't be able to function. I'm in a little bit of denial around the magnitude of the issue, just to stay functioning. It's just how our brains work. So I think it's important to situate denial in the context of a defense mechanism, that it's what we do to manage distress, threatening information, to protect ourselves emotionally. And it's a common and natural response that we have to it's almost like, it's certainly not conscious, it's at an unconscious level, but it's sort of what we do when we can't really process something. It's like it just doesn't compute, and you know, to accept reality on its own terms throws us into a place of, you know, I can't even go there, can't even think about it. So I think it's important to situate denial. The reframe is that it's a mechanism that humans employ to manage and protect ourselves, that it's social. It's not an individual phenomena, that we participate in denial socially, meaning, and Kari Norgaard, a colleague of mine who wrote a book called Living in Denial years ago, talks about how denial is a social phenomenon. In other words, I kind of need other people to communicate with me who are part of that for it to work. Like I can't just kind of go around in my own world with it. Right. So I think that, you know, as far as the way forward here, we do, to your point, we need to sort of get away from, oh, you know, those people are in denial. There's no point in trying to engage with folks on that end of the spectrum. We need to focus on, you know, people who are only believe, you know, terminology like believers, the converted. You know, I think we need to get away from that. I think we should have a more nuanced approach. And again, this is the hard part. This is maybe the hardest part,
right,
is to open our hearts and our minds, yeah, to what is going on underneath the denial. What is the pain that's there? What's happening there? And how do we tease that out? And I think the only way is by naming it and demonstrating as much empathy as we can.
And empathy, you're right. Empathy can be hard, particularly right now. I want to get to a comment from a listener on Twitter. It says, the myth of the individual ego warrior is as old as the creation of the litter bug. Companies that profit from disposables transferred responsibility for the harm onto customers, and it has continued. Now, Renee, you work with companies as a consultant. What do you think about that comment from our listener? And also, what is the role of our corporate citizens when it comes to engaging in this conversation?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's entirely on point, the comment from the person. So what I think we're seeing and we're living through right now is in fact an evolution and a shift in our ways of understanding the role of the individual in the system, as we talked about earlier, that it's starting to become more nuanced, and organizations are starting to gradually step up and into roles of leadership, recognizing the profound levers that organizations, particularly corporate entities, multinationals, and so forth. So I think we're living in the midst of that right now. Is it happening fast enough? No, of course not. You know, but it is starting to happen. We're seeing glimmers of that. I partner with organizations and companies in the private sector, as well as public sector, who are ready to step into that role of leadership and ready to see this as a we and us kind of situation. You know, like 5 years ago, you know, I would go to these conferences and you would hear companies say, well, you know, consumers aren't ready for this and consumers don't, you know, want this. And we need to do one more research, you know, one more big research study to show that consumers are ready and wanting this. You know, and that is like old. You know, we are way beyond that right now. And so right at the moment, I think what we're seeing are organizations who are the ones that are really on it and tuned in. They're seeing that they have to meet this and anticipate the fact that more and more people are now going to be demanding a level of responsibility and accountability. And that is now part of being a viable organization and company in today's world. I see that happening. So, you know, in a way, I think there's a lot of positivity. I'm also, you know, I'm aware there's new entities like consortiums and groups that bring together people working in the corporate sector. I'm thinking about Drawdown Lab right now, part of Drawdown, the organization. You know, people are reaching out to them every day who work within companies who want to be doing something and they don't know how. So it really is quite a dynamic time in that field. And I think we're going to be seeing some really innovative work coming out of that in the next, you know, within the next year or two.
Okay. Renee Lertzman is a psychologist, a consultant, and founder of Project Inside Out, where she uses psychological insights to help communities and individuals move forward to address climate change. Renee, I'm so glad to have had you join us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Loved being with you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Jonathan Chang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Kim Skog, Grace Tatter, Sydney Wertheim, and Jack Beatty is our news analyst, and our executive producer is Jonathan Dyer. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.